Technology scared him, so he tried to scare people into sharing his fear. The Joker in the movie The Dark Knight, a post-9/11 allegory for how terror breaks down reassuring moral categories, is out to scare everybody into dismantling their moral compasses. He doesn't understand the world and its people much better than Kaczynski, but similarly wants to believe he does. If he were confident in that belief, he wouldn't feel quite so driven to confirm it. Like Kaczynski, he thinks he can get people to reveal how they're like himself. Kaczynski expected people to take up the anti-technology cause. The Joker expects people to reveal how easily they'll turn against each other. He gets his bank-robbing flunkies to eliminate each other, makes two thugs fight to the death with a broken cue stick, drives Harvey Dent into turning killer, goads a detective into an attack that gives the Joker his opening to break out of jail, and contrives for Batman to break his one rule. "I'll show you," he tells Batman, "when the chips are down, these civilized people, they'll eat each other." Having seen Batman use terror to get what he wants, the Joker sees, or wants to see, a kindred spirit, and wants Batman to see that too. The Joker tells mobsters meeting in the back of a restaurant, "I know why you choose to have your little group therapy sessions in broad daylight. I know why you're afraid to go out at night. The Batman. See, Batman has shown Gotham your true colors, unfortunately." The Joker means to make the good citizens of Gotham show their true colors as well. Repeatedly, he panics the populace into providing him with exactly the opportunities he wants, like when he drives a judge straight to a car bomb, scares people into evacuating the hospital so he can reach Dent and snatch a busload of hostages, or makes police sharpshooters so frantic they nearly shoot those hostages themselves. "You crossed a line first, sir. You squeezed them, you hammered them to the point of desperation, and in their desperation, they turned to a man they didn't fully understand," Alfred tells Bruce, before suggesting that Bruce doesn't fully understand the Joker either. "Some men aren't looking for anything logical like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world burn." Batman scares the mob into turning to the Joker. The Joker wants to scare everybody into turning into the Joker, like the 9/11 terrorists scared Americans into becoming torturers. The Joker's wrong, though. Not completely, but enough that two boatloads of people terrified for their lives refrain from blowing each other up. People can be better. Resisting impulses to turn on one another, giving others the benefit of the doubt, is often the best strategy for everyone in both the short term and long. Suspects facing the prisoner's dilemma, the opportunity to earn freedom by turning against each other, more frequently come out ahead by staying quiet and gambling that their accomplices will zip it as well. Batman trusts correctly that the Joker will see no explosions from those two ships. We gamble on each other's better nature all the time. Sometimes we're wrong. But living without taking those gambles means living gripped by paranoia, which isn't living fully. The human race continues because we haven't all killed each other off. Fright characterizes Batman's rogues gallery unlike any other. His enemies dress as if en route to a Halloween masquerade party full of trick-or-treat tricksters, evoking chills and thrills. The Wayne's uncostumed killer, Joe Chill, reflects the fears that give birth to Batman. People grow resistant to fear, though. Graduated exposure to Batman may inoculate Gotham's criminal element against him. He's a vaccine whose active ingredient is intimidation. Vaccine-resistant strains, the less easily intimidated criminals, survive and thrive by seizing opportunities previously enjoyed by more fearful felons. Despite Bruce Wayne's contention that criminals are a superstitious, cowardly lot, the most dangerous monsters often feel too little fear to hold themselves back. The psychopaths. Case file 5-1. Scarecrow. Real name, Dr. Jonathan Crane. First appearance, World's Finest Comics number 3, fall 1941. Origin. A gangly bookworm victimized by school bullies and raised by a grandmother who regularly punishes him by leaving him alone in a dilapidated chapel where flocks of birds might peck, harangue, and torment him, Jonathan Crane masters his fears by growing up to become a master of fear itself, a psychology professor whose unorthodox methods include firing a gun in class while demonstrating the acquisition of fear. The standoffish, shabbily dressed psychologist never fits in with other faculty. Why buy nicer clothes when that money could go into his book collection? After lecturing on how protection rackets make money by making people afraid, Crane decides to become the symbol he already resembles, a symbol of poverty and fear combined, the perfect symbol, the scarecrow. Going into business as a one-man protection racket, he gets unethical businessmen to hire him to drive their rivals away through his use of violent scare tactics, even murder. Unfazed after the university fires him for inappropriate teaching methods, like shooting that gun in class, the Scarecrow steps up his reign of terror, striking again and again, until Batman and Robin bring him down. Guy dresses up as something horrific, goes out into the night, and terrifies his enemies. He's acting out from deep, visceral trauma, probably childhood. Sound like anyone you know? Batman, discussing the Scarecrow with Robin, Year 1, Batman, Scarecrow, Number 1, July 2005. Where Bruce Wayne dresses like Dracula to scare the guilty, Jonathan Crane, yet another villain who inverts key aspects of the hero, dresses like a scarecrow to panic the innocent. At first, the Scarecrow fails to secure his place in Batman's rogues gallery. Appearing only twice in the early 1940s, he doesn't become a recurring enemy until after he reappears in 1967. Readers found him more interesting once he moved beyond terroristic scare tactics and into the realm of psychophysiological manipulation. When he returns, he uses a chemical spray to overwhelm victims and crime fighters with the most primal human fears: heights, animals, darkness. Over the years, he develops variants of his fear toxin, typically administering it as a gas to prey on individuals' personal fears, like Batman's dread of losing those closest to him, with hallucinogenic effects, inducing vivid visual and auditory hallucinations of whatever stimulus or situation frightens each of them most. Sometimes, instead of inducing fear, the Scarecrow unleashes drugs that eliminate fear in order to make the exposed recipients reckless to the point of endangering their own lives or among those for whom only the fear of consequences restrains their darkest impulses, hazardous to the lives of other people. Are any of ex-Professor Crane's toxic techniques plausible? Yes. Psychoactive substances, psychologically active, altering perception and mood, a.k.a. psychotropic, as Batman refers to Crane's toxin in Batman Begins, including both approved medications and recreational drugs, generally operate by boosting, blocking, or mimicking the body's natural hormones and neurotransmitters, the chemicals that regulate nerve cells' activity and relay signals throughout the nervous system. Nerve gases produce their effects by increasing the activity of the body's most prevalent neurotransmitter, acetylcholine, which enables learning, memory, and muscle contraction. A rapid burst in acetylcholine activity can produce lasting damage by exciting an eruption of muscle contractions, including respiratory seizures, that can kill within a minute. If Crane could create a drug that operates on other neural systems, targeting the ones related to fear, and then release that drug in gaseous form, he would essentially invent a different kind of nerve gas. Our natural stimulants, the neurotransmitters known as the catecholamines, fire up the nervous system to increase heart rate, blood flow, and the brain's oxygen supply. Specific catecholamines are epinephrine, a.k.a. adrenaline, and norepinephrine, a.k.a. noradrenaline. Catecholamine deficits correlate with depression, and excesses predict stress, anxiety, and physical reactions that resemble our responses to danger: racing heart, palpitations, tremors, hyperventilation. Elevating these physical reactions can heighten a fear response, but might also intensify anger or positive emotions as well, just as stimulant substances like caffeine, cocaine, and amphetamines can enhance either unpleasant feelings like anxiety and paranoia or pleasant feelings of euphoria and well-being. Both activate systems as part of the innate fight-or-flight response, reacting to danger with readiness to attack or run and hide. Fun physical activities, for example, outdoor adventure tasks like canoeing and climbing rocks, can elevate catecholamine levels as well. To instill fear specifically, Crane's toxins must target neural areas associated with the fear side of that equation. Increasing motor responses associated with fear, like rapid heart rate or respiration, could help. But he can't rely on that alone, because his victims might interpret those sensations as enhanced excitement or anger. The antidepressants known as serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, SNRIs, operate much like the more widely used selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs. SSRIs combat some forms of depression, anxiety, and obsessive thinking by making the brain use its serotonin, a calming neurotransmitter, more efficiently, selectively increasing effectiveness in some neural regions more than others, so that different SSRIs will work better with different problems. Some will work better on social anxiety, while others might better treat eating disorders. SNRIs provide an added kick with norepinephrine stimulation. Although clinicians have used SNRIs to make anxiety sufferers feel better, a villain like Crane could selectively target different arousal systems, conceivably to make anxieties worse. Crane doesn't want to calm them down, though, so he wouldn't increase serotonin's effectiveness, too. In fact, he'd likely include a selective serotonin blocker in his recipe. Some SNRIs also enhance dopamine, an important neurotransmitter of which Parkinson's patients have too little, and schizophrenic individuals generally have too much, which might figure into his toxin's hallucinogenic effects. Within the brain, Crane would hit the limbic system, the so-called animal brain, a donut-shaped collection of brain parts at the border between the brainstem, controlling basic life support deep down in the brain atop the spinal cord, and cerebral cortex, where conscious thought and more advanced functions take place across the brain's surface. The limbic system includes the hippocampus, which processes explicit memories for long-term storage, a cluster of parts collectively known as the hypothalamus, which governs some motivation, hunger, thirst, caring whether we freeze or overheat, and emotion, sex drive and the flight-or-fight response to danger, and the amygdala, which links our motivations and emotions to the stimuli that set them off. Actually, amygdalae, plural, since there's one on each side of the brain. Electrical or chemical stimulation to the hypothalamus or amygdala can make an animal leap to attack, or with only a slight difference in target location, cower in fear. Crane might also target the brainstem's locus coeruleus and other structures involved in the central stress circuitry, giving this psychology professor gone bad many options as he induces stress, anxiety, and outright panic in his victims. There's more to us than automatic stimulus response, though, just as there's more to fear itself than arousal activation. Both physiology and cognitions, our perceptions, memories, and interpretations, together, can create our feelings. According to Schachter and Singer's two-factor theory, whenever we experience forms of general autonomic arousal, e.g., elevated heart rate, similarly associated with different emotions like fear, joy, and anger that involve similar general autonomic arousal, we interpret our own feelings and label them according to available cues. Arousal from one source, like a shot of epinephrine, could become happiness when exposed to someone else who acts euphoric, or testiness around a person who acts irritated, a process known as excitation transfer. Arousal fuels emotion. Cognition channels it. We can often think our way through our feelings. The scarecrow once uses a device that sends vibrations to the parasympathetic nervous system, the division of the autonomic nervous system that normally calms the body. Batman works his way around its effects by asking himself how Crane stays calm and realizes it's simply because the psychologist knows there's no reason for fear. Since it was your gadget, it was logical to understand that I had nothing to fear either. Simple mind over matter, Scarecrow. He successfully tells himself not to interpret those physiological sensations as fear. This happens long before the Scarecrow, through repeated exposure to his own toxins, loses his capacity for fear. Complete loss of fear by someone who grew up fully able to experience it is so rare that the phenomenon lacks systematic research and classification. But it does happen, as in the real-life case of patient SM, whose specific amygdala damage left her unafraid even when held at gunpoint. Like her or the research animals who no longer frighten due to experimental cuts to their fear centers, Crane no longer feels afraid of anything, and he misses that sensation. The master of fear grew up wanting to accept his fears and control them, not eliminate them altogether. His own toxins won't induce fear in him either, whether because he has developed a tolerance, resistance to their effects, or damaged his fear center so severely. A victim of his own devices, the boy who grew to cook up some fear for others now desperately seeks new ways to serve it to himself. Case File 5-2, Hugo Strange. Real name, Dr. Hugo Strange. First appearance, Detective Comics number 36, February 1940. Origin. Debuting in the comics as a mad scientist who fights Batman months before the more colorful Joker and Catwoman come along, back in the days when readers could accept a villain using a fog and lightning machine to cover a bank robbery, instead of making a fortune off the fact that he has invented a fog and lightning machine. He's the first candidate to become a Moriarty to Batman's Holmes, ahead of the curve in many ways, only to get supplanted in every way as Bob Kane and crew kept creating flashier foes. Strange, for example, spreads fear dust around the city months before the Scarecrow appears. He dies a lot. Many appearances end with Strange presumed dead, only to survive somehow and later return to vex the Dark Knight yet again. In his Bronze Age appearances, he discovers Bruce Wayne's big secret and makes several attempts to take his place in the Batman costume.
I can know what it feels to be the Batman psychologically, but not physically. God, how I envy him. How I hate him.
Hugo Strange in Batman, Legends of the Dark Knight, number 11, November 1990. Rebooted after Crisis on Infinite Earths, Strange re-enters comics as a prominent psychiatrist whom Gotham's mayor hires to develop a forensic profile on the city's new bat-clad vigilante and to form a strategy for turning public sentiment against the Batman. Strange articulates his thoughts to a lingerie-clad mannequin. Donning his own version of a Batman costume helps him understand his target's point of view, not the worst of strategies, as it helps him recognize the compulsion, the symbolism, and the disinhibiting empowerment that comes with a costume. Except that Strange quickly envies Batman's freedom to run rampant through the night in that outfit, and escalates his own actions to kidnapping the mayor's daughter in order to frame Batman. Strange deduces Batman's identity. The secret seemingly dies with him when he gets shot by police and falls into the river after Batman clears himself of Strange's frame. Reminiscent of the original Strange's use of fear dust, this Strange soon teams up with Scarecrow Jonathan Crane to strike terror into Gotham, though the two quickly turn against each other and Crane impales Strange on a weather vane. Later posing as a psychiatrist running standard stress evaluations on Wayne Enterprises employees, Strange tries but fails to coax a drugged Wayne into admitting he's Batman. Concluding that he erred in ever thinking Wayne was Batman, Strange breaks down and finally goes to Arkham Asylum instead of faking another death, not without dressing like Batman again in this course of this story. Because keeping Hugo Strange out of a bat costume would be like keeping cross-dressing filmmaker Ed Wood out of a skirt. As a psychiatrist writing a forensic profile, Strange is not formally a forensic psychiatrist whose main criminological responsibility would be to evaluate competency to stand trial or claims of mental illness in insanity defense cases, nor does he regularly work as an offender profiler. Offender or criminal profiling, known by many names, involves identifying an offender's demographic and individual characteristics, including signs of specific mental illness, from crime scene evidence and behavior reported by witnesses. Profiling had a long history before it had a name, as early as George Baxter Phillips and Thomas Bond's efforts to profile Jack the Ripper. Since the FBI built its profiling program in the 1970s, a wide range of techniques have emerged, with five main approaches that vary in the manner and degree of emphasis on statistical probability, scientific method, deductive versus inductive reasoning, perspective taking, training, and guesswork. Criminologists, psychologists, and psychiatrists like Strange, well, psychiatrists, nobody's just like Hugo Strange, use personality profiling to construct a picture of the offender's likely personality traits and personal history. With criminal investigative analysis, the FBI's method, law enforcement officers trained in profiling review crime scene patterns and indicators and draw from interviews with past offenders to estimate the type of organized or disorganized offender likely to have committed the crime. Investigative psychology, conducted primarily by academic psychologists and criminologists with no investigative training, provides a fresh perspective by using typologies and past empirical studies to construct profiles. Behavioral evidence analysis emphasizes deduction and critical thinking, integrating more forensic psychology and scientific hypothesis testing into the process. Geographic profiling analyzes neighborhood characteristics and crime scene locations on the map to identify travel routes and determine where the offender is likely to recreate, live, and work. Criminal profiling depends on fundamental assumptions that, 1, the crime scene reflects the perpetrator's personality, 2, the modus operandi stays noticeably similar over time, 3, so does the signature, and 4, so does the personality. The instrumental modus operandi, meaning method or mode of operation, MO, is the criminal's standard method of committing a crime, the action the person uses in order to make that crime happen. As part of his MO, the serial killer Ted Bundy often wore a cast or sling to look like he was harmless and in need of assistance before he would force a woman into his car. A non-instrumental signature, actions not necessary for committing the main crime, puts the offender's own personal stamp on the crime. Leaving a playing card after committing a murder does not help the joker commit or try to get away with that misdeed. It boldly declares his ownership of the crime. Repeat offenders, especially serial and spree offenders, whose crimes serve emotional more than instrumental needs, produce patterns in their actions most suitable for profiling because their cases seem to reflect the offender's psychopathology. Criminal profiling has grown as a profession, and critics of criminal profiling have grown loud. Like some stockbrokers, sports writers, and professional psychics, profilers may point to their hits, their accurate predictions, while failing to note the frequency of their misses. They may diffuse criticism by saying, "I'm not always right," without confirming how often they are right. Retrofitting can occur, retroactively interpreting new facts and selectively remembering or misremembering details of a prior prediction to say these new facts prove the prediction. Inter-rater reliability rates would be helpful. Will two different profilers looking at the same crime scene information without consulting with each other develop similar profiles? Individual criminals do not fall into neat typologies, where those who show one set of behaviors consistently match each other on other behaviors. Actions do not necessarily reveal specific motivations. The fact is that different offenders can exhibit the same behaviors for completely different reasons, says Brent Turvey, a forensic scientist critical of the FBI's approach. Many forensic psychologists and psychiatrists express skepticism, calling for more empirical validation, with a majority in one survey believing it's simply not scientifically reliable or valid. The profilers themselves cannot see eye to eye with their field, riddled as it is with contradictions and disputes. Locking on to an innocent suspect who fits a profile, a false positive, upends that person's life and delays identification of the true culprit. In contrast, investigators can overlook a guilty person erroneously when that offender does not match the profile, a false negative. Jumping to conclusions locks the expectations of investigators in a way that can be difficult to overcome, because discovering that we have erred jostles our worldview. We do not easily give up our beliefs, even in the fact of contradictory evidence, belief perseverance, a fact that saves Bruce Wayne for a time while Strange sticks to his assumption that a wife's murder must be what drives Batman. But once Strange discovers that it had instead been Batman's parents who died, means that Strange hangs on to his belief that Bruce is Batman for a long time. Giving up that belief comes so hard for him that doing so contributes to Strange's mental breakdown. Chapter 6. The Superstitious, Cowardly Lot. Criminal Nature. Criminals are a superstitious, cowardly lot, so my disguise must be able to strike terror into their hearts. I must be a creature of the night, black, terrible. Bruce Wayne, Detective Comics number 33, November 1939. Are criminals really a superstitious, cowardly lot? When the main person who can say what's going on inside a criminal's head is that same criminal, who may mislead out of sheer habit, who might not even understand his or her own thoughts and motivations well enough to share them, and who will say whatever it takes to shirk responsibility, we should be wary of trusting even our best source, much less our own guesses. From observations of their behavior and the skills they demonstrate in specific situations, including the errors that lead to their arrests, we know that many criminals demonstrate poor problem-solving skills and difficulty applying logic. For example, delinquent youth favor ineffective solutions when evaluating problems in social situations. The kinds of cognitive weaknesses Batman hopes to exploit when he decides to prey on their superstitions have already impaired their ability to generate non-aggressive solutions, conceive of legal ways to get the things they want and need, and then keep themselves from getting caught. But cowardly? Which requires greater fearlessness, doing the right thing or breaking the law? Nervous, fearful individuals, on average, commit fewer crimes. Low fear of punishment reduces the effectiveness of some deterrence against crime, not only potential incarceration, but the risks involved along the way, and may therefore predispose fearless individuals like extroverts and psychopaths to take risks and seek thrills the fearful might not pursue. Batman Begins' Scarecrow might succumb to his own fear toxin, but The Dark Knight's Joker and The Dark Knight Rises' Bane each demonstrate abnormal deficiencies in ability to feel fear. Cowardice and superstition aside, is Batman's assumption that criminals share common traits right? What is a criminal personality? Out of the different personality factors most thoroughly examined over thousands of studies, extroversion, the personality dimension that includes outgoing, assertive behavior and social fearlessness, correlates most strongly with law-breaking actions. Because extroverts have higher needs for excitement and stimulation to break the daily boredom, they are also most likely to run counter to the law. Extroverts, people high in extroversion, are less afraid in general than are the more reserved, less outgoing, and less sociable introverts. Fearlessness should give extroverts greater capacity for both criminal and heroic behavior. Lack of inhibition characterizes both extroversion and psychopathy, which we'll look at shortly. But extroversion and psychopathy are different personality dimensions. Introverts, as easily as extroverts, can have shortcomings or strengths in the areas of empathy and moral concerns, even if extroverts more easily act out the riskiest impulses or those most likely to impact others. Attending more to the external environment than their own inner experience, extroverts predominantly seek gratification from outside themselves. Introverts occupy themselves and stay out of other people's way. Introverted fiends exist, of course. Serial killers Ted Bundy and John Wayne Gacy may have been charming, outgoing fellows. But think how often a serial or mass murderer's neighbors say he was a quiet sort, kept to himself. Extroversion and sociability are separate dimensions. Extroverts include likable social butterflies as well as sadistic social predators. For the Joker and Penguin, committing a crime with no audience would be pointless. They don't always understand people as well as they think they do, especially not the better part of human nature. Nor do they generally care about anybody else's welfare aside from the Penguin's devotion to his mother. And yet they love social gatherings and public demonstrations, habitually seeking gratification from others, as is typical of extroverts. The Riddler, who also loves attention and can be quite the showman on stage, lives to beat others, but takes less interest in other people's activities and lives. Fearlessness and consciousness of others can help the shapeshifter Clayface impersonate others, where nervousness and lack of extrapersonal awareness would interfere with even the most conscientious introvert's performances. Introverted loners like the more reclusive Mr. Freeze, Mad Hatter, and Poison Ivy dislike crowds and avoid social interactions for long periods of time. Until a beautiful woman named Nora tries with limited success to bring him out of his shell, Victor Freeze contents himself with his studies during the years before he becomes Mr. Freeze. The Mad Hatter shows less interest in people than in their hats. Likewise, Poison Ivy grows up compensating for her social paralysis by occupying herself with non-human, non-judgmental plants that can't reject her. Unable to relate to others and uninterested in developing better social skills, both the Hatter and Ivy resort to manipulating others via mind control to get what they want. The extroversion-introversion factor, instead of presenting a strict dichotomy where a person is clearly one or the other in every single situation, presents a broad range of qualities with most people showing a mixture of extroverted and introverted traits, even if one main pattern dominates. Extroverted Harvey Dent is an outgoing district attorney until tragedy makes him resent his own basic nature, and he tries to withdraw from everything he previously valued. One might argue that many of Batman's other foes are introverts who overcompensate for their social shortcomings by attacking the society they never fit into. Regardless of individual designations as extroverts and introverts, the villainy of all the major Bat foes grows out of their respective social interests and resentments. Why else would they commit their crimes wearing outrageous outfits? The roots of all evil. Some theories on crime. The optimistic conformity perspective on crime assumes human beings are creatures of conformity, ready to do right so we can fit in with others. Conformist theories hold that the desire to fit in motivates us to follow social conventions and laws when we can. But we might also break laws when lawbreaking strikes us as the way to get the things that can help us live up to society's materialistic expectations. Humanistic psychology, a branch that views the individual human being, not some therapist, as the best determinant of his or her own abilities and needs, is one example of a conformist perspective. Humanists focus on our better nature, emphasizing healthy people's personal growth instead of dwelling heavily on our worst qualities. According to humanistic psychology founder Abraham Maslow, nature gave us an inborn drive to become better people and to pursue our potential as human beings. And whether the many challenges we face along the way help us advance or hold us back is up to us. Aside from the innate drive to fulfill one's potential, humanistic psychologists believe strongly in free will, and therefore hold individuals responsible for their own actions. Maslow said we must meet our most basic physiological needs before we can progress into higher levels of personal growth, working our way up through the hierarchy of needs, Maslow's stratified pyramid. Maslow said we work our way up from the most basic needs, and that deficiencies in the lower levels will require too much of our time, attention, and effort for us to progress smoothly into higher levels with more advanced psychological functioning. People stuck in the lower levels fixate on their deficits even after meeting basic needs, choosing to focus on whatever they still don't have instead of appreciating what they do have so they can flourish as human beings. Selena Kyle's poverty and homelessness, Pamela Isley's timidity and familial neglect, and Oswald Cobblepot's physical deformity and victimization by bullies during their respective childhoods get them each in the habit of focusing on their deficits and later lead them each to seek fulfillment with things and thrills as the adult Catwoman, Poison Ivy, and Penguin, habits that continue long after they meet their basic needs. Mother, father, child, and cat goddess guardian, everything I never had, Selena remarks while reflecting on the goods that fill her residence. And now it's mine. A home of stolen happiness. Criminal behavior can emerge among those who have grown frustrated over unmet needs or among those who choose to stay mired in a lower level, simply wanting more and more. Psychopaths hunger for baser needs so thoroughly that Maslow felt they could understand love no better than a person blind from birth comprehends the color red. The hierarchy of needs provides a useful construct, a popular model with both uses and limitations. Where might Batman himself fall in this hypothesized hierarchy? In seeking to reach peak efficiency as a crime fighter, he actively decides against pursuing self-actualization, the fulfillment of his potential as a human being. One criticism of Maslow's theory is that his definition of self-actualization overemphasizes individual development. Rather than spend another 20 years studying under Master Kurigi to attain illumination, Bruce Wayne chooses to forego his personal growth so that he may combat evil right away. The more pessimistic, non-conformist perspective views humans as undisciplined creatures not inherently motivated to conform, beasts itching to flout social norms and wantonly commit crimes, born to be bad, but held back by society. As the Joker argues in The Dark Knight, all it takes is a little push to bring out the beast in anyone. For example, Sigmund Freud's psychodynamic approach, see Chapter 9, and later Neo-Freudian views, new Freuds subscribing to modified versions of his position, explain behavior in terms of unconscious motives and drives, viewing human nature as essentially antisocial, biologically driven by the id's pleasure principle to get what they want when they want it. When the Joker gets an impulse to kill or steal, he acts on it without hesitation. Both of these larger perspectives, conformist and nonconformist, and attributing our basic inclinations to inborn nature, take the nature side of the long-running nature versus nurture debate. A philosophical exchange over whether we act as we do because of how we're born, nature, or because of how life treats us, nurture. Humanistic psychologists criticize both sides of the nature versus nurture debate for being too deterministic, saying something other than free will determines everything we do. And yet their view includes some determinism by saying we're innately motivated to become better people. Existentialist psychology, a more philosophical approach, winds up being less optimistic by shucking that bit of determinism to stress the importance of free will as we each find meaning in our own existence. Anti-Batman tales, stories of villains whose backgrounds and characteristics mirror Batman's, depict the power of nurture in determining whether a person becomes a hero or a villain by rearranging the circumstances of the Dark Knight's origin. Whereas Bruce Wayne sees a mugger kill his parents and grows up to fight criminals as Batman, other boys who separately see police officers kill their criminal parents grow up to become costumed cop killers, the Wrath and Prometheus. In an alternate universe, the hoodlum Joe Chill raises Thomas Wayne Jr. to become the supervillain Owlman after a police officer kills Thomas's mother and brother Bruce. In the nurture arguments corner, the learning perspective assumes all these boys started out with neither innate goodness nor evil, no inherent readiness to conform or rebel. This perspective instead declares that we all learn our actions from how circumstances reinforce or punish our behavior, or by witnessing how other people act. The branch of psychology known as behaviorism espouses the learning perspective, arguing that psychology should focus on measurable actions when trying to explain humans and non-humans alike. Not Freud's unconscious mind, not other psychologists' conscious processes, not even an individual's heredity. John B. Watson, behaviorism's founder, who posited that classical and instrumental conditioning, explained in Chapter 5, could influence everything a person does, once said, "Give me a dozen healthy infants, well-formed, and my own specified world to bring them up in, and I'll guarantee to take anyone at random and train him to become any type of specialist I might select. Doctor, lawyer, artist, merchant chief, and yes, even beggarman and thief, regardless of his talents, pensions, tendencies, abilities, vocations, and race of his ancestors." Albert Bandura expanded on this to include observational learning, aka imitational learning, to account for how we acquire actions we see others perform, behaviors we pick up from personally having been reinforced or punished. Watson demonstrated how both classical and instrumental conditioning could cause phobias. Bandura showed how easily people imitate aggressive actions modeled by others. And many effective therapeutic techniques have evolved from their methods. Behaviorism and its variants, like Bandura's social behaviorism, remain influential to this day, even though other views like cognitive psychology, a modern branch of psychology using the scientific method to explore internal mental processes, memories, attitudes, beliefs, problem-solving, information processing, or cognitions, have in some professionals' minds eclipsed it. Although cognitive behaviorists apply behaviorism's principles to cognitive processes, the strictest behaviorists scoff at the term cognitive behaviorism as an oxymoron that contradicts itself. Bruce's parents alert him to the need to help others. Teaching him through both word and deed, they strive to reinforce his better qualities. They discuss the reasons for putting others first, and they model altruistic behavior in both life and death. As Bruce grows, he keeps learning more about how his parents lived their lives. Their lives, not just their murders, have taught him to be heroic, which seems to make a strong case for nurture, except that he also inherited their nature in his genes. So which is right? Learning perspectives that emphasize nature, or biological perspectives and others that stress nature? Both. Few who seriously research these issues will argue 100% for either side. Winning the debate, the interactionist perspective asserts that nature and nurture interact to make us who we are. Heredity provides a natural potential that life experience may or may not bring out. If your identical twin develops schizophrenia, you have about a 50-50 chance of developing it yourself, only a little lower if separated at birth. With no heredity influence, your odds would be no higher than anyone else's. But if heredity controlled it completely, every person with a schizophrenic identical twin would develop schizophrenia too. Nature plays the greater role in some things, and nurture exerts more power over others. Bad seeds and early misdeeds. Juvenile delinquency. A socialized offender routinely breaks laws because of having picked up criminal behaviors from his or her environment, the product of learning through conditioning and observation, in contrast to the non-socialized offender, which psychologist Leonard Berkowitz called the individual offender, whose offenses arise from a long series of frustrations over unmet needs. Instead of learning criminal patterns from others, the individual offender comes up with some independently. A non-socialized juvenile delinquent tends to become much scarier than a socialized one, and is more likely to stay that way. Despite spending time as Batman's sidekick, the juvenile delinquent who becomes the second Robin never outgrows his antisocial inclinations and eventually becomes Batman's enemy, a deadly antihero and sometimes crime lord. Conduct disorder refers to a disruptive, repetitive, and persistent pattern of antisocial behavior during childhood or adolescence in which the youth keeps violating the rights of others or major age-appropriate rules and social norms. These behaviors fall into four groups. 1. Aggression to people and animals. 2. Property destruction. 3. Deceitfulness or theft. And 4. Serious rule violations. Truancy, running away, staying out at night without permission starting before age 13. Juvenile socialized offenders who commit antisocial acts as part of group activity usually have age-appropriate friendships, show concern for the welfare of their friends or gang members, and are unlikely to betray friends by informing on them. Few youngsters of the group type remain delinquent past adolescence. For all the trouble they may get into, they're still learning social skills through peer interactions, such as they may be. "I want to break this window. You got the last house." Non-socialized juvenile offenders with conduct disorder exhibit more bullying, physical aggression, and other cruelty toward peers, and may be hostile and abusive toward adults as well. Sheer callousness, flat disregard for others' feelings or well-being, is their most striking feature. Rejected and unpopular, they lack close, confiding relationships. If they do connect with someone else who shares their antisocial interests, the person will usually be distinctly older or younger, not an immediate peer, and their interactions stay superficial. The earlier their antisocial actions begin, the more likely it is that the problems will persist for life, albeit transformed into adult manifestations. Those with childhood onset have symptoms of conduct disorder before age 10, and those with adolescent onset do not, although concealment of the misbehavior may cause caregivers to underreport problems and overestimate age of onset. Juvenile delinquents who do not start engaging in antisocial actions until adolescence tend to outgrow that behavior, whereas those who engage in pre-adolescent antisocial actions frequently do not. Commissioner Gordon's son, James Jr., an infant born in Batman Year One, and the cute kid Two-Face threatens to shoot in the movie The Dark Knight, during his childhood kills animals out of curiosity, dresses like a homicidal maniac for Halloween, and apparently murders one of his sister's friends. A doctor who's certain the boy's problems do not indicate autism wants to give him a PCL, the psychopathy checklist, to the surprise of James Sr., who knows they give that out at Arkham. Gordon says the test measures psychopathology, which means the study of mental illness, although many people, even professionals, use the term to refer to mental illness itself. He's technically right, if imprecise, since psychopathy falls within psychopathology. Can good people raise a monster? Family situations where solitary, aggressive, and childhood-onset conduct disorder appear reveal parents with severe marital disharmony, instability, alcoholism, mental illness, antisocial behaviors, and other problems, frequently but not consistently. Twin and adoption studies provide evidence that both genetic and environmental factors influence the emergence of conduct disorder. Differences in brain activity among youths who lack empathy are correlational. Maybe the fact that aggressive adolescents show strong activation in the amygdala, the brain structure linking emotions to the stimuli that evoke them, and ventral striatum, an area that responds to feelings of reward, when watching others get pain inflicted upon them, means that their brain differences make them enjoy watching pain. But it may be the other way around. Maybe their enjoyment at seeing pain causes those areas to fire up, so that does not prove the neural circuitry created the psychopathic tendencies. Where does evil come from? We don't exactly know. James Gordon Jr. is a product of more than genes, upbringing, and head injury. He's a child of Gotham City, the city that killed the Waynes and gives rise to a never-ending line of hoodlums and freaks. At age 17, he enters a drug trial for a medication called diaxamine, designed to stimulate peptide production in the part of the brain that controls human emotions. It helps people with severe antisocial neurological function experience empathy. The drug is fictitious, so do not ask your doctor if diaxamine might be right for you. No medication can create empathy in someone who has never felt it. None. However, superhero comic book stories are science fiction. Even the non-superpowered Batman stories in everything from his gadgets to the Joker and Scarecrow's specialized toxins. Even within the story, the drug does not work as intended. Prodding Junior to contemplate the differences between himself and others, this newfound perspective simply makes him decide normal people are weak and dysfunctional, while men in the drug trial like himself are stronger and more highly evolved. He refigures the medication's formula to create a drug that can suppress empathy rather than stimulate it. The story does not reveal whether his attempt to taint baby formula with the inverted medicine has succeeded, ending instead with Dick Grayson and Gordon Sr. wondering if James Jr. has infected thousands of infants with a drug that could help them grow up to be sociopaths. Again, this seems unlikely, but we can't rule out the possibility. The brain is a tricky thing. Experimental lesioning, inflicting damage to specific brain parts, like the amygdala, can change which emotions we feel in reaction to particular stimuli. A chemical capable of damaging the amygdala and other neural regions that process how we feel about others could conceivably lower its recipient's empathy. And among individuals with either inherited or environmentally created psychopathic potential, raise the odds they grow up evil. Integral to the definition of conduct disorder is that the individual is violating age-appropriate societal norms and rules. The child who grows up in an environment where truancy and violence are the norms, where adults all around him or her actively train and encourage such behavior, whether in a war-torn third-world nation or a mafia-dominated part of uptown, might not qualify for any mental disorder. Adaptive delinquency, in which the behavior is an attempt to adjust to the manifold disadvantages of poverty and inner-city living, not a mental illness, might better describe the thievery committed by orphans Selena Kyle and Jason Todd, both of whom have practical reasons for dodging the foster care system, especially Selena after an orphanage director tries to drown her, even though that means scraping to survive before they become, respectively, Catwoman and Batman's second Robin. Evil by many names. Commissioner Gordon worries that his son's a sociopath. James Jr. calls himself a psychopath. Which one has it right? They both do. The words, synonymous according to some writers, not synonymous but overlapping according to others, each suit James Gordon Jr., along with most of Batman's foes. Psychopathy, sociopathy, antisocial personality disorder, disocial, dissocial personality disorder, sadism, adult antisocial behavior. These terms and more amount to psychological professionals' attempts to pathologize a non-psychological term, evil. Psychotic does not mean psychopathic, nor does antisocial mean unsociable. No matter how many fictional characters or even real-life experts you've heard confuse the terms. Conditions like schizophrenia and senile dementia can turn good people psychotic as easily as bad ones. Psychotic individuals have lost touch with the real world, as indicated by gross reality distortions, notably hallucinations and delusions. See Chapter 8. The world's most dangerous people tend to be coldly sane. They may think and feel differently from most people, but they know enough of what's really going on to use it against others. A psychopath, who also happens to be psychotic, is still heartless, even at times when the hallucinations and delusions go away, as when the schizophrenic Mad Hatter uses a thinking hat to help himself think more clearly. Schizophrenic Maxi Zeus, cured of his delusional belief that he is the Greek god Zeus, nevertheless sells the Joker venom mixed with ecstasy as a recreational drug, dangerous despite his nobler intentions. More antisocial than psychopathic, Maxi enjoys greater freedom at Arkham, staying out of the maximum security area where asylum administrators store more dangerous criminals. Antisocial means antithetical to social norms, in opposition to society's rules and expectations for how civilized people act. Antisocial behavior violates people's rights in big ways. An antisocial individual may be unsociable or sociable. Either one, it's a separate issue. Some can be quite charming, at least superficially, while they go about manipulating others, like the Joker charming his way into psychiatrist Harleen Quinzel's heart. The first edition of the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders treated sociopathy as a whole category of different mental illnesses for people ill primarily in terms of society and of conformity with the prevailing cultural milieu, a category that included antisocial reaction, dissocial reaction, addiction, and sexual deviation, not the contemporary view. A non-sociopath can have some addictions and paraphilias, the modern psychiatric term for sexual deviations, conditions in which the person is unable either to experience or enjoy the normal sexual response cycle without actions or imagery most people consider bizarre, without being a criminal. As long as you and your consenting adult partner have fun with your whips, chains, stilettos, balloons, pastries, puppets, garden tools, or whatnot, together in the privacy of your own home, there's nothing antisocial about that. Even if it interferes with your ability to enjoy mature relationships to the point that it qualifies as a mental disorder, you haven't necessarily violated anybody else's rights. Modern writers tend to use the poorly defined term sociopath interchangeably with psychopath. The purist, however, considers the sociopath a habitual criminal offender who has not been properly socialized. Those who make distinctions may treat sociopathy as a product of environment, less deeply rooted than psychopathy, or view the sociopath as being more capable of interpersonal bonds like loyalty, even as they hurt outsiders. Ra's al Ghul sometimes calls Batman a sociopath. He will be grieving, but he will most likely lean on his sociopathic nature, al Ghul says, a remark that fits some meanings of sociopath but not others. Keep in mind, the 500-year-old eco-terrorist may not have read a DSM since 1952. These days, the greater issue diagnostically is distinguishing antisocial personality disorder, APD, from psychopathy. APD is a DSM diagnosis. Psychopathy is not. And yet many therapists and criminologists concentrate on psychopathy as the more meaningful construct when trying to understand evil. An antisocial personality disorder diagnosis focuses more on objectively assessable actions, lawbreaking, deceitfulness, impulsivity, aggressiveness, recklessness, irresponsibility, with the specific trait of remorselessness as just one of the possible symptoms. Psychopathy places greater emphasis on internal qualities, specific emotional and interpersonal qualities like grandiose self-concept, lack of empathy, and rejection of responsibility for one's own behavior. Psychopathy's essential quality is lack of conscience. They should know the difference between right and wrong, but at heart they don't understand it and they don't care. The criminal psychopath regularly breaks laws, as opposed to other psychopaths who, despite their lack of empathy or moral concerns, might have other reasons for not committing numerous criminal or antisocial acts. Because the DSM defines APD in terms of antisocial actions, based largely on earlier studies of prison inmates' characteristics, the majority of inmates meet its criteria. This should come as no surprise. Test developers who create assessment tools based on thousands of previous criminals' answers should find it no more shocking or impressive when later criminals produce high scores than if most mimes nod yes a lot while completing an Are You a Mime questionnaire. Criminality is not an essential component of psychopathy, even though Hervey Cleckley interviewed incarcerated psychopaths for The Mask of Sanity, his landmark book that laid the groundwork for defining and studying psychopathy. The title refers to the social mask that conceals the true nature of psychopaths who outwardly mimic normally functioning persons. Cleckley identified numerous traits common among psychopaths, including superficial charm, absence of nervousness, unreliability, untruthfulness, and insincerity, lack of insight, lack of remorse or shame, inadequately motivated antisocial behavior, as opposed to non-psychopaths who might commit anti-